From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston.
And I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C. It's Here and Now. This evening, President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping will hold their first face-to-face summit. Well, face-to-face on the computer screen. And sure to come up is rising military tensions over Taiwan. It is a crucial player in the world economy that Beijing claims is part of China. Let's talk now to Paul Hanley. He directs the Carnegie Endowment's Beijing Center and is now in Singapore. Paul, thanks for staying up very late to talk to us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
So let's first start on your side of the world. How does Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party frame U.S.-China relations going into this meeting?
Well, Scott, I suspect that President Xi will feel some good momentum coming out of the sixth plenum last week, where the third historical resolution confirmed his status on par with previous leaders Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping.
You're just consolidating his authority, yeah?
Consolidating his authority, but the 20th Party Congress isn't for one more year. It's the fall of 2022. And so over the next 12 months, President Xi will be very focused on solidifying his domestic political position at home, and he will want to lower the risk of international disruptions, especially those in the U.S.-China relationship. And so I think he will want to come out of this meeting, in a sense, trying to stabilize the U.S.-China relationship and reduce the risk that U.S.-China relations could complicate his domestic political goals.
So stabilizing from Beijing's perspective. How about from Washington? We know the Biden administration has spent many months doing a China review to kind of set its own framework for U.S.-China relations in this administration.
Well, it's interesting because the two leaders, I think, are coming into this virtual summit with different approaches, and they're looking for different outcomes. President Biden, he is coming from Rome and Glasgow, where he attended the G20 and the COP26 in person, unlike President Xi. And he is signing the infrastructure bill on Monday, an important legislative victory for President Biden. And he'll try to leverage all that to demonstrate that the U.S. is back. The U.S. can deliver, Western-style democracy can work, working again with allies and partners, and that this puts the U.S. in a stronger position to deal with China and other foreign policy challenges. And so I think President Biden's goals for the meeting will be to stress his view that this is now a much more competitive relationship. President Biden has talked about extreme competition with China, but that while the two sides have differences, and we're going to be competing more, it does not have to lead to conflict.
So competition on one hand and seeking stability on the other, how do those come into play with Taiwan, one of the most important flashpoints that surely is going to come up in this conversation?
I suspect that Taiwan will be front and center on the agenda, and for good reasons. I don't expect any major breakthroughs, but it will be very important, Scott, for the two leaders to better understand each other's positions and how each of them view the current set of dynamics. I think that where possible, the two leaders will want to offer reassurances that neither leader intends to make fundamental shifts away from the policies that both countries have pursued. And in that context, I think there's also a need for the two leaders to talk more about crisis management mechanisms. In the event that there's some unintended military incident or collision around Taiwan or in the broader Asia Pacific, so that that doesn't escalate into full-blown conflict.
Yeah. And I do note that there is talk of potential cooperation on climate and some other issues. So that could be part of the conversation, too. In the end, just very quickly, how do you expect this to end? What do you anticipate coming out of this conversation? Kind of a grand statement, agreement, or something else?
Well, there's no expectation, I think, for a joint statement between the two leaders or any. You know, when I was in the White House, we were always trying to come up with specific deliverables for summits and presidential meetings, but I don't think they're going to have any of those. I think the meeting simply creates an opportunity for the two leaders to make clear their intentions, their priorities and concerns, and begin to set the terms of what is really a new era of bilateral relations between the U.S. and China. And it's characterized by rising competition, greater risk across a range of domains, political, military, and economic issues. And I think if the two leaders can establish a tone and an atmosphere that's conducive to solving problems in the relationship, this would be a positive outcome.
That's Paul Hanley, director of the Carnegie Endowment's Beijing Center. Paul, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Scott.
Negotiations at the COP26, the International Climate Summit in Glasgow, wrapped up over the weekend. There were agreements on curbing emissions and a blanket call to draw down the use of fossil fuels. But will they be enough to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2050? Let's bring back Alden Meyer. He is senior associate at E3G, a climate change think tank. He's been to almost every COP meeting, including this one. Alden, welcome back.
Good to be with you again.
Alden, as we said, you're a frequent flyer at these meetings, but this summit was where action had to be taken, serious action, to reduce the most catastrophic effects of climate change. How close did it come to accomplishing that?
Well, it set the goal of accomplishing that in the next 2 years, but we're not there yet. The actions that countries have taken this year so far and at the Glasgow COP resulted in cutting the emissions gap in 2030 by about 20 to 25%. So we're about one quarter of the way there. But unless countries step up with much more aggressive action next year at the COP in Egypt, we won't get to 1.5.
And what's the reluctance? I mean, if is it that not everyone believes the problem is as serious as it is? The countries that are polluting the most aren't stepping up to the plate?
No, I think the good news is that we did get acknowledgement in Glasgow that this is a serious problem. It's a climate emergency. The problem is that many of the biggest countries have yet to put higher ambition on the table, and that's partly because of powerful interests that want to block that kind of action in their own countries. And in terms of some of the big developing countries, it's because they think that unless the U.S., Europe, and other developed countries provide more support, they aren't going to do it.
All right. Talk about some of the heavy hitters, India and China. Originally, there was a blanket call to phase out fossil fuels entirely. India rewrote it into a drawdown because of how much the country relies on coal. To what extent did the meeting and the success of it hinge on these two countries, China and India?
Well, China and India are very big players in the COP, as they always are. And you're right, they did water down the coal language, but I should note this is the first time in the 30-year history of this process that there's been an explicit call to start even phasing down coal. So that was an important breakthrough to get that language in the decision. And the reality is that we don't expect either India or China to phase out coal by 2030, which is the current Paris commitment period. So phasing down is a big step. The question is, will either of them do it in a meaningful way over the rest of this decade?
What did the U.S. promise? It's not the highest polluter, but it's a significant one. What did the U.S. contribute to this?
Well, the U.S. made a contribution early in the year at President Biden's climate summit when it committed to try to reduce U.S. emissions by 50 to 52% by 2030. Of course, there's still a challenge getting the support from Congress needed to do that. It's a work in progress. Where the U.S. hasn't really stepped up yet is providing financial assistance to countries that are already on the front lines of climate change and facing catastrophic impacts such as hurricanes, typhoons, flooding, and other climate-related events. There is a process that was launched in Glasgow to talk about how to mobilize those resources over the next couple of years, and we're hoping the U.S. will bring some concrete proposals to the table when they reconvene.
The overall mood of the meeting seems to be one of disappointment with no hard deadlines, no enforcement. To what extent did world powers miss the mark? And to what extent do you think actual progress was made? I mean, can we take heart in anything here?
Well, yes, I think we can take heart that there was a declaration that we needed to step up in the next year or two to try to get more in line with what the science says we need to do. There was a commitment by the U.S. and other developed countries to try to double the amount of climate finance going to help countries in the South adapt to the impacts of climate change. But there's still a disconnect between the statement by many world leaders that climate is an existential crisis and the level and urgency of mobilization that we're seeing. There's still not the level of action we need by any means, and we're running out of time.
Alden, when these meetings happen, there's an awful lot that goes on behind the cameras. I wonder, when you're walking the halls, talking to representatives from various countries, what you heard that you think would shed light on what's really going on?
Well, I think if you talk to representatives of the developing countries, particularly the small island states and other vulnerable countries, there's an attitude almost of despair that their future is seriously threatened, and also that they don't feel they're getting the assistance they need to cope with the climate impacts that they're already experiencing. Some of these countries are having to spend a substantial part of their gross domestic product just responding to climate change. That's one view. If you talk to some of the progressive European countries or others that really want to see acceleration of efforts, they will say that we made some progress here, but not enough. So it really depends partly who you're talking to, what the response is, and what the mood is.
Thank you very much. Alden Meyer, Senior Associate at E3G, a climate change think tank, who just returned from Glasgow, Scotland. Thanks a lot, Alden.
Good to be with you again.
Brian Terry is in the business of preserving African-American recipes and the stories behind them. He is a noted cookbook author and chef-in-residence at the Museum of the African-American Diaspora. Terry is editor and curator of a new book, Black Food: Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora, which, as the title suggests, is a full sensory experience, not just a bunch of recipes. Brian Terry joins me now, and welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Now, it's hard to find a word to describe this project. You call it a communal shrine to the shared culinary histories of the African diaspora. So, it's a shrine, it's a set of essays, it's artwork, there's even a Spotify playlist attached to this. What was the creative vision that started all this?
We need to go back to 2015 when I started my role as chef in residence at the Museum of the African Diaspora in San Francisco. And Linda Harrison, the former executive director, invited me to co-create this program. She wanted to move the museum beyond just being a fine art museum and really being a space for community to gather and to help to educate and move people. And so we started this program. The first event we did was Black Women, Food and Power, which you know is one of the chapters in the book. And I expected people to drive up from Los Angeles, or I thought people might even fly in from Portland. But the fact that we had people flying from the East Coast for a two-hour program in our museum just showed me that there was a hunger for this type of programming. And so I thought about doing it in book form. But it was always on the back burner until 2020, when we saw the uprisings. And I decided that this was the time to gift the world with a book that had these diverse voices throughout the African diaspora talking about their various experiences in connection with Black food.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is so much to this project. The chapters are big themes and narratives whose stories are told in the food. So let's look at chapter 2, Migration, and we'll weave in a song you picked for this chapter, All Blues from Miles Davis. Last night I made a recipe from page 87 in this chapter of Migration, the rice pudding flan.
Whoa.
Flan de arroz con dulce, sticky rice, custardy flan, caramelized sugar. It's a lot of work, but also very smooth and sweet. But I gather the rice in this recipe helps to map the geography and the important history here, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, the rice is a through line throughout Black food, and there's a complicated history with people of African descent and rice. We know that many of the enslaved Africans that were brought from the Senegambia region to the New World, they were brought because of their expertise in rice growing. But this recipe, just so you know, this is just such a standout, and you can tell me it is labor intensive. Paola Vallez.
Oh my goodness! I mean, there's caramelizing the sugar on one hand, and then there's the rice on the other hand, and then of course making the custard and baking it and then sticking it in the fridge. My goodness!
Was it worth the labor? What was the payoff for you, Scott?
Oh, it's so worth it. First of all, I mean, it makes so much, and you can only eat a little bit at a time.
It's rich. It's rich.
It's a rich but powerful and sweet experience because, like this history, like this cookbook, there are so many flavors that are combined here.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things, and I'm glad you just talked about the kind of multiplicity of offerings to the book, because one thing that I was clear about when I would go to these national gatherings that were geared towards fixing our broken food system, I felt like there are a lot of educational and class biases in these spaces. And so often the conversation started with the heady intellectual ideas around food, or, you know, immediately talking about the public policies. And it bothered me that the people most impacted by our quote unquote broken food system, whether they're migrant farm laborers or, you know, people living in urban centers that are often described as food deserts, I didn't see these people in the room. And they certainly weren't at the table driving the conversation about how we should be creating change in our food system. Those moments help me think differently about how we can help people change their habits. And when I think about my own kind of origin story, I like to think that my food justice activism started when I was in high school and I heard the hip hop song Beef, which so brilliantly talks about the violence of factory farming and the impact on animals.
Let us begin now with the cow, the way it gets to your plate and how. The cow doesn't grow fast enough for man, so through his greed he makes a faster plan. He has drugs to make the cow grow quicker. Through the stress, the cow gets sicker. 21 different drugs are pumped into the cow in one big lump.
Storytelling isn't just about like text, it's about recipes, it's about the visual art. You know, I think that there's so many ways that we can help people have this immersive experience and really move them to think about their own habits and attitudes and politics and how they might want to shift them. And I think a recipe can be just as powerful as a heady intellectual essay in doing that.
There is so much about origin stories, especially in this chapter. There's one essay in the migrations chapter that calls food the source code from village to dungeon to canoe to the plantations. Boy, I love this term source code. What does it mean to you?
Food carries history. It carries memory. It connects us with our ancestors, the land from which we've come, whether it's the kind of real or imagined land of our ancestors. And I think that it's important for us to connect with this so that we really know who we are and that we can move towards liberation.
Speaking of liberation, that's the one other chapter I wanted to talk to you about, Land Liberation and Justice, chapter 4 in your cookbook. You chose one song for this section, Herbie Hancock's Watermelon Man. Let's listen to that for a second. Now, the watermelon, of course, can carry a racist stereotype. Why did you pick this song as one of the songs for this section?
I'm glad you brought up the fact that there's a history of racial stereotypes in African Americans. And, you know, I've been aware of this history since I was a child. It was something that my family talked about. As they saw it, watermelon is one of our sacred fruits. You know, it was one of the crops that many enslaved Africans, newly freed Africans, I should say, after emancipation. This was a way that they had financial sustainability. They would sell watermelon to actually provide for their families. And there was the longest time, Scott, where I refused to eat watermelons. And it was because I didn't want to reproduce or buy into these racial stereotypes, and me eating watermelon would, you know, substantiate whatever biases some of my classmates or their families might have had. Me making that choice was what I needed to protect myself at the time, but also getting over that hump and really embracing this. I mean, look, watermelon, if people haven't had fresh from the farm watermelon that's grown in the South, you know, it's just, you can't deny it. It's sweet, it's hydrating, it's one of the most perfect foods, I think, for like a hot summer day. And so Watermelon Man, Herbie Hancock's song, is quietly kind of like, you know, a theme song for me. And it really symbolizes my own ability to grow, and also the importance for me to just live my life without the concern of the white gaze. Like, if I like watermelon, I'm going to eat watermelon, and I don't care what anybody says about it.
Yeah. So. Now, one dish from the liberation chapter that I'm planning to make is okra and shrimp purlieu. It's a dish with Carolina gold rice, garlic, onions, ginger, okra, and shrimp. The recipe says it is a dish of pain, resilience, and celebration. There's a lot to unpack here. But again, there's kind of rice and forced labor, and it's in the liberation section of the book. Why?
Yeah. This is one of the dishes that is a staple of the Gullah Geechee people from which B.J. Dennis, the chef who offered this recipe, those are his people. And, you know, I think that this just goes back to the point that I made earlier about the way in which food can carry these histories of forced migration, of disruption of cultures. But I didn't want that to be the focus of the book. I wanted the book to be about our agency, our brilliance, our magic, you know, what happens when we aren't focused with this albatross of white supremacy. And I think this is one of those dishes that represents that. It's drawing on this history, and it's, you know, rice is obviously such an important staple and contested ingredient in terms of the history in the Carolinas, but just the ingenuity, creativity, using what's on hand, sea animals, which are such an important part of Gullah Geechee cuisine, and then okra, which is, you know, one of the staples from West and Central Africa that we see throughout the diaspora. And so ultimately, I feel like this one dish is full of stories in so many ways, I think, represents what I see as this kind of cutting and pasting and reworking and remixing of ingredients and cooking traditions and flavor profiles throughout the Black diaspora that create these dishes. I hope the book would really push people to dig deeply and learn more about, like, the origins of not just the food, but the people who created it.
The book is Black Food: Stories, Art, and Recipes from Across the African Diaspora. And the editor and curator is Brian Terry. Brian Terry, great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Scott.
And you can find the two recipes Brian Terry and I talked about at hereandnow.org. Try the flan. It's here and now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Closing arguments began today in the murder trial of 18-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse. He's the man from Illinois who drove to Kenosha, Wisconsin last summer during the height of the protests of the police shooting of Jacob Blake. Rittenhouse killed two men and injured another during the protests. He claimed self-defense and gave tearful testimony last week. Joining us now from Kenosha is WUWM's Chuck Kornbach. And Chuck, what are the main arguments that each side has made over the course of this two-week trial?
Well, the prosecution says that on the night of August 25th, 2020, defendant Rittenhouse was carrying a large gun that he shouldn't have had, that he left his post guarding a used car lot that was not being bothered at the time, and that he overreacted to perceived threats from Joseph Rosenbaum, Anthony Huber, and Gage Grosskreutz, protesters that night. During shootings that occurred a little while later, Rosenbaum and Huber died. Grosskreutz was wounded. The defense has said all along that Rittenhouse feared for his life. He testified that he did not want to kill anyone. Thought he had to do so to preserve his life, and that he was part of a group of armed civilians that did have permission from the used car lot owners to help protect the buildings. That's a disputed point, but that's what Rittenhouse says.
So today the jury is expected to be reduced from 18 to 12, so alternates will be let go. Tell us what happens next.
Right. The first thing that happened today was that count six, a misdemeanor gun charge against Rittenhouse, was dismissed. The defense has been trying to get that charge dismissed for some time. It's a question of whether Rittenhouse could legally have that long gun when he was under 18. He was 17 at the time of the shootings. But the judge today, just as we got started, dismissed that count six. Now, there still remain five counts and some lesser includeds, as they say, or say lesser options for the jury if the jurors feel they cannot The state has not met its burden of proof for the original charges. And these lesser counts still face substantial charges. Jail time, prison time, Rittenhouse would still go away for decades if he's found guilty on even some of the lesser options.
So there's a lot of attention being paid to this, of course. 500 National Guard troops are on standby there in case there's any unrest after the verdict is decided. What is the feeling there right now? To what extent are people anxious about the jury's decision?
Well, we should note that Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, a Democrat, put the guard on standby late last week. He'd been criticized last year by the Republicans for not immediately activating the guard. Now he has him on standby near Kenosha, but promises not to use them until any local officials request help. I would say there is some tension here. There are numbers outside the courthouse of protesters pro and against are relatively small, but a conservative group last week posted Prosecutor Thomas Binger's home address. That kind of thing is concerning to many.
It's been noted that this was a dramatic trial. At times, the judge was shouting admonitions at the prosecution. Kyle Rittenhouse himself gave emotional testimony. But beyond that, what kind of impact is the trial likely to have?
Well, there's going to be a debate, depending on the verdicts, over the treatment of black defendants versus whites in the criminal justice system here. That's been raised by Jacob Blake's family, that concern. There'll be questions about armed civilians showing up during protests in the future, and maybe some courtroom concerns about video evidence and digital enhancements of some key evidence in the case.
Thank you very much, WWM's Chuck Hornbach. Danny Fenster is coming home. The 37-year-old American journalist has been imprisoned in Myanmar since May. Last week, the military regime governing Myanmar sentenced him to 11 years in prison. But former Ambassador Bill Richardson has negotiated Fenster's release, a release that surprised many. For the latest on Danny Fenster's release and what's happening in Myanmar, journalist Michael Sullivan joins us from Thailand. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I want to start by reading a brief statement from Danny Fenster's family. They say, "We're overjoyed that Danny has been released and is on his way home. We cannot wait to hold him in our arms." And then they want to express their gratitude to Ambassador Richardson and friends in the public who expressed support for Danny during these months when he was in, as you have called it, Michael, one of the most notorious prisons in Myanmar. Give us the backdrop to this. The military seized power in February. It did so in a coup. Not long after, it arrested Danny Fenster. Why?
For the same reason that it arrested a lot of other journalists. They just didn't like what he was doing. But there's a little question about what he was doing, because when he was arrested, he was the managing editor of Frontier Myanmar magazine. And before working for Frontier, he had worked for another outlet called Myanmar Now. And it's his work there that appears to have gotten him in trouble with the military. They didn't like some of the things written about them and decided to do something about it after the coup. But Danny Fenster had not been working for Myanmar Now for 7 months at the time of his arrest. So that was a little strange. But his name made it to the top of this list. And in May, about 3 months after the coup, he was arrested at the airport in Myanmar's biggest city, Yangon, just as he was about to board a plane back to the Detroit area to see his family. And then he was held in, yes, the infamous insane prison where they keep all the political dissidents ever since, basically.
So can you explain why the government would come down so hard on him, keeping him in prison, sentencing him to hard labor for years with the promise of more sentences to come, and then acquiesce to this American ambassador, Bill Richardson, when he put pressure on them? What does Myanmar's government have to gain in all of this?
Well, to answer the first question, I think if to go after an American journalist working in Myanmar, I think that sends a very clear message to the Burmese journalists who are working in Myanmar. And that message, as Phil Robertson, the Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch, said last week, it is, if we can do this to someone else, if we can do this to a foreigner, think of what we can do to you. Did they acquiesce in allowing him to be freed? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what quid pro quo there was there. I don't know if there was any at all. But I'm sure that the military regime probably wants to have a little of the pressure that's put on them by the international community lessened a bit. But at the same time, they basically don't really care if that happens, because as long as Russia and as long as China keep supplying them with what they need and keep blocking any action at the United Nations to come up with any firmer sanctions against Myanmar, then they pretty much have what they need to keep on doing what they've been doing for the past several months since the coup and before that for decades when they were in power.
And what they're doing, you have spoken about before, it is basically, as you say, a scorched earth policy. What is the military government of Myanmar trying to do?
They want to make this resistance to the coup go away. They did not bank on this resistance being as strong and as widespread as it's been. They're really kind of spread out all over the country. Before, when they were fighting the ethnic minority groups on the fringes, that was just on the borders, right? But now they're finding themselves fighting their own citizens all over the country, even in the central heartland. And they're hard pressed, they're stretched thin. They want this problem to go away right now. And I think that's why they've started this, what some analysts are saying is this recent new offensive in the north of the country, especially in Chin State, in the northwest of the country, where they've been going after towns with this scorched earth policy, which looks a lot like what they used against the Rohingya in 2017. Remember that, when 700,000 Rohingya had to flee across the border into neighboring Bangladesh? It's that same kind of tactic, because it's that kind of tactic that they've used before in the decades that they've been in power. But the difference this time, I think, is just that there's too many people who are actually actively opposing them.
Michael, bring in the case here of the Nobel laureate Aung San Suu Kyi. Her party won more than 80% of the seats in a national election 1 year ago, but two of her party's members just received long prison sentences. The same may happen to her. What is she facing?
Oh, she's facing several charges of sedition, incitement, corruption, violating coronavirus restrictions. And if those aren't enough, they'll come up with more. The military very, very clearly wants to take Aung San Suu Kyi out of the political equation in the future in Myanmar. And they will do whatever it takes, whatever trumped up charges it takes to make this happen. There's no question that she's going down. The only question is for how long. Will they actually convict her and send her to prison? I find that difficult to believe, but I find it completely believable that they just end up convicting her and then putting her under house arrest, as she was before, for almost two decades, and they'll just leave her there like that. But her political career in Myanmar, as far as the military is concerned, is over.
That's reporter Michael Sullivan joining us from Thailand. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
We want to take a few minutes now to pay tribute to a dear friend of the Here and Now family. Petra Mayer, books editor at NPR, died unexpectedly on Saturday from what's believed to be a pulmonary embolism. She was 46. Listeners and we at the staff, we heard Petra as she was, the genuine article, the real deal, the book evangelist who loved to talk about reading in her way. She appeared on Here and Now for years, and this summer she became an irresistible regular, coming on to, as she put it, to yell about her favorite books. Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa worked with Petra on all that yelling and has this remembrance.
Petra Mayer was so much fun. Who can forget the time when her cat Godfrey butted in on her conversation with Robin Young?
Petra Mayer joins us now.
Oh, God, my cat just walked into the mic and knocked it over. Get out of here, you bum. Hang on, I'm going to bodily shove him off the table.
Oh,
shoot.
Petra, this is...
Okay.
You know, no animal abuse in our book segment, but...
No, I gently chucked him off the table. I love him.
And who but Petra would immediately send a picture of the culprit? Petra was also easy to work with. Ask her to come up with a list of books to yell about, talk about George Orwell, or mingle with cosplaying fans at a Comic-Con, and she'd pull a segment together for you. And if she didn't think it was her thing, she'd cheerfully direct you to the right person. And Petra loved books. Deeply. You can hear it in her voice. Listen to her talk about one of her picks, Cassandra Cause, The All-Consuming World.
the language that they use is just like fireworks on the page. You know, it's very rare that a novel makes me have to stop and look up words, but I kind of had to do it a lot for this book. And I actually didn't mind because every time I looked up a word, I'd be like, ooh, that's a perfect choice. So it's not an easy read, but it will blow your tiny mind.
As a Here and Now producer, I've edited well over 1,000 conversations, probably closer to 2,000. And I can tell you that hearing that genuine love come through so clearly is also very rare. But with Petra, it happened every single time. Most of all, Petra was a joy. I used to look forward to Book Expo, the trade fair where we'd find out what the publishers had in store for us, because it gave me the chance to hang out with her. When the pandemic put an end to that, we'd still exchange emails about cats, Food Network shows, and of course, books. I don't think I'll ever be able to pick up a Murderbot book again without thinking that it was Petra who introduced me to Martha Wells's cranky but lovable creation. Petra's fun, love, and joy lit up her Here and Now conversations. Her passing leaves behind a great void, not only for me, but for the show and for our book-loving listeners. But I'm grateful for the time that she spent with all of us.
That's Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa remembering Petra Mayer of NPR Books, who died Saturday at the age of 46. You're listening to Here and Now. Over the weekend, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen tried to ease concerns over inflation. It's now at its highest level in three decades. She told CBS on Sunday that rising inflation is a pandemic story.
I think it's important to realize that the cause of this inflation is the pandemic. It all but shut down our economy. It boosted unemployment to almost 15%, and we've been opening up in fits and starts.
When the economy recovers from COVID, she said, prices will ease. Derek Thompson has been thinking about this. He's staff writer at The Atlantic, and he joins us every Monday to talk about what's on his mind. Derek, welcome back.
Good to be here. Thank you.
All right. Gas, food, housing prices, the price of everything seems to be up. We haven't seen inflation like this in a generation, so remind us why this matters.
It matters because people need to buy gas to move around. They need to buy cars. And right now, inflation, especially in the energy and transportation sector, is just about as high as any print on record. Gasoline prices are up 50% if you look at the unadjusted 12-month average. Used car prices up 27%. Energy and transportation are really leading the way. And it's trickling into other things. You know, there are vehicles that require gas to move things around the country, like, say, food. And so as a result, if transportation is expensive, then you might pay for it at the grocery store. And as a result, you see food prices going up as well. You know, people, even though their financial situations in this country are better than they've been overall in many years, often they can't really enjoy their higher savings and their higher wages because prices are going up all over the place.
Yeah, and I just saw food prices by some measures are up 12% over last year. Mm. We just heard Janet Yellen and Jerome Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve, have said all year that this is a temporary thing, that it's connected to the pandemic. And when cases ease, the factories and the ships and the trucks and all those drivers will revert to normal. But what is the counter argument that this might last longer than they think?
Yeah. Well, before I give the counter-argument, let me say the counter-argument might be wrong. It might simply be the case that the inflation that we're experiencing right now is indeed transitory. The counter-argument, though, is that you should believe that inflation might last because it is lasting. Inflation theoretically could have started to go down over the summer and early fall. It didn't. This is partly because of the stimulus and economic recovery plans that were assigned by Biden and President Trump. But it's also because you've seen these supply chain snafus. You've seen a labor shortage in the U.S. And as a result, companies are charging more for goods. If you have a shortage of labor and a shortage of stuff, and fundamentally inflation is a lot of money, a lot of spending, spending cash, seeking a relatively finite amount of stuff, you're going to see the price for that stuff rise. So you have those effects. You have the fact of early retirement, declining immigration, which is sort of sapping the economy of prime age workers. This is forcing companies to raise wages for workers that are out there, somewhat good news. But those higher wages should also keep prices elevated. So, you know, I think there is overall a pretty good argument for the idea that we're going to see relatively lasting inflation in this economy.
Well, and I see some economists describing a wild card in all this as being psychology. That is, you know, companies who think prices are going to keep going up, they're going to raise prices more. And consumers who think we're going to have inflation, well, they're going to buy more to avoid high prices later and keep pushing up inflation. So is that an unpredictable part of this whole picture?
It is unpredictable, and certainly when you get to talking about hyperinflation, which is not what we're seeing, I think, that is often the psychological dynamic that is at play. If the price of oranges are going up $1 every day, then what you're going to do is you're going to buy a lot of oranges, right? Now, what does that do? That means that the store that everyone else is trying to buy oranges at suddenly has basically no more oranges to sell. So they can, you know, 10x the price of oranges, and someone will pay for the oranges. And so, you know, the scarcity multiplied by demand creates this hyperinflationary spiral. To be clear, I don't think that's what we are seeing. I don't think that's what we will see next year. A lot of the problems that you heard Jerome Powell talk about, they are going to resolve themselves. The supply chain snafus are very likely to get better. The amount of savings in the economy is likely to come down a little bit, and some people that are staying on the sidelines will have to jump into the labor force, and we'll have our labor shortage at least somewhat ameliorated. So I do think that there are reasons to think that inflation is not going to hit this sort of psychological death spiral that some fear. At the same time, I believe the argument that we'll be looking at a little bit more inflation for the near future.
Now, very quickly, the Federal Reserve is obviously watching this. They've told us they're planning to take their foot off the economic gas pedal by reducing bond purchases, which can kind of pump money into the economy and feed higher prices. If inflation lasts longer than they think, what can the Fed do?
Well, the Fed can reduce bond purchases, that's true. They can raise interest rates, that's true. And the other thing they can do, which sounds a little touchy-feely, but is actually really important, is that the Fed can move markets, and by extension, corporate and even consumer behavior, by just talking. If the Fed says, for example, we're not going to raise interest rates until labor force participation rates increase by 3%, companies will invest differently. So they can buy different, they can raise interest rates, but they can also just communicate their vision of the future.
All right. Derek Townsend of The Atlantic, thanks as always.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. This is Here and Now.